Hello, and welcome to episode 52 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Congressman-elect Jamie Raskin, former senator from District 20 in Tacoma Park, Maryland. How are you doing today, Jamie?
Great, Jordan. I'm delighted to be with you. And District 20, by the way, is about 80% Silver Spring, 20% Tacoma Park.
Excellent. So the first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, thank you for inviting me on the show. And let's see where to start. Maybe I should talk first about my time spent in the state Senate because I just resigned last week. And that's a melancholy moment for me because it was a period of great productivity and forward progress for Maryland. And I got to participate in the enactment of lots of breakthrough legislation. So I was the floor leader on marriage equality. Maryland became the first state in the union to pass marriage equality without being told that it had to do so by its state Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
We became the first state to pass marriage equality south of the Mason-Dixon line. We became the first state to pass marriage equality in the legislature and then have the people uphold it against a referendum attack. And so that was definitely a highlight of my time.
How did you get the idea to lead the fight for marriage equality in Maryland?
Well, I'll tell you the interesting story. I'm a professor of constitutional law. I've been doing that for 26 years now. Mm-hmm. And it became very clear to me just purely as a matter of logic that marriage discrimination against gay people was unconstitutional. There's no rational basis for it. I perceived that way back in law school in the 1980s at a time when the Supreme Court actually upheld laws criminalizing gay sex in Bowers v. Hardwick in 1986. But I saw that those were obviously unconstitutional as a violation of equal protection and the right to privacy.
So in the 80s, the United States Supreme Court struck down sodomy laws as unconstitutional?
The Supreme Court in Bowers v. Hardwick upheld sodomy laws.
Oh, which
as
were
constitutional?
No, were they fairly? Did those sodomy laws were they fairly enforced against heterosexual couples as well?
No. So in Bowers v. Hardwick, which was a case out of Georgia, there was a gay man named Michael Hardwick, whose apartment was invaded by the police. And they went into his bedroom, and so they charged him with sodomy. When he brought a case against the sodomy law in Georgia with the ACLU, they brought it against the sodomy law generally because it was written in general terms. Nobody could engage in oral sex and other particular proscribed sex acts. But the Supreme Court, in its outburst of homophobia, treated it as though it were just a challenge by the gay community and said that this is an act that's been condemned for millennia as immoral. And, basically the conservatives took the position that how could this be a violation of people's liberty under the Due Process Clause if in 1868, when the Due Process Clause was added to the Constitution in the 14th Amendment, all the states banned gay sodomy or sodomy generally. They were unwilling to look at the right to privacy under the Constitution.
It was just kind of like Jim Crow. There wasn't equal enforcement across the population of this law.
No.
If a heterosexual couple was giving oral sex to each other, the police weren't invading their home and arresting them, were
no.
they?
No. There was no parity or equality in the enforcement of it. Of course, the civil rights and civil liberties movements took the position that it would be unconstitutional either way. When you apply it just against the gay community,
yeah.
it's a violation of equal protection and a violation of the right to privacy. If you apply it against everybody, then it's just a violation of the right to privacy. But either way, people have a right to their sex lives. And that was a clear implication of Griswold versus Connecticut, which had struck down the ban on birth control.
Hmm.
And the Supreme Court said that under due process, people have a substantive right to make their own decisions about procreation, reproduction, and sexuality.
What year was the law passed in Maryland where that legalized marriage between same-sex couples?
We did it in 2012.
So in the 1980s, is it fair to say that's when you got the idea that you wanted to kind of go on a crusade against this decision by the Supreme Court and hopefully get it overturned? Did you spend 25 years?
No. And there are people who did do that.
How did you get the idea?
So the story I want to tell is that when I announced for the state Senate back in 2006, and remember, I was running against a 32-year incumbent who was the president pro tem of the Maryland Senate and the boss of our local political machine.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And everybody considered my chances to be an extreme long shot. I was like the darkest of the dark horses. And
for our listeners, he actually beat Ida Rubin, who is a senator.
Well, when I announced, you know, there was an article in the paper quoting a pundit who said Raskin's chances of victory are impossible.
Yeah.
And 9 months later, when we got 67% of the vote, there was another article in the Post where a pundit said that Raskin's victory was inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
So it went from impossible to inevitable in a nine-month period. But the pundits are never wrong. But anyway, when I made my announcement, I laid out everything that I wanted to do. I wanted to go to Annapolis and fight to abolish the death penalty,
mm-hmm.
to abolish mandatory minimum drug sentences,
mm-hmm.
to restore voting rights for the ex-felons, to pass marriage equality, to pass aggressive environmental policies to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to promote Maryland-grown produce in our schools, to defend the right to vote, to...
That's quite an ambitious agenda.
Yeah, I laid out the whole thing, but what the story I want to tell is when I was finished, this woman came up to me and she said, Jamie, great speech. I loved your speech. But one thing, take out that stuff you've got in there about gay marriage,
mm-hmm.
because it's never going to happen,
mm-hmm.
and you know it's not going to happen, and even the gay candidates don't talk about it, and it makes you sound like you're really extreme, like you're not in the political center.
Mm-hmm.
And I swallowed for a second there because I didn't want to offender. I didn't have that many supporters with me that day. What I said was, I'm really glad you're saying that to me because it makes me realize that it's not my ambition to be in the political center. It's my ambition to be in the moral center. The political center moves around all the time.
Well, how did you shift the moral, how did you shift the political center to your moral center, right? Because, and when you started there, you were a freshman senator with no political experience as an elected official. And all of a sudden, you see that, well, in 2006, we're now in 2016, so 10 years later, you have a slew of over 100 pieces of legislation, very progressive, that you got passed as a champion of, that originally wasn't seen as very politically viable. How is it that you were able, as a relatively young and inexperienced elected official, able to shift the political center to your moral center?
Well, you know, on the marriage equality question specifically, mm-hmm. I had a lot of great support. Rich Mattolino, our first openly gay senator, mm-hmm. in Maryland history, was a tremendous force here. And just his presence in the Senate changed things because people had to deal with the reality of a gay senator who had a life partner who mm-hmm. he could not marry legally here, and children. And that made a very big difference for us. We had...
The floor leader, or was he?
I was the floor leader on it, and it was in my committee, Judicial Proceedings
Committee. Why is that? Why were you the leader instead of someone who had a vested personal interest in the matter?
Well, Rich did a lot of campaigning with me, but, you know, I was the one who shepherded it through my committee,
okay.
the Judicial Proceedings Committee.
He was in a different committee.
And I was able to bring several senators over. And I think that...
Did it bring more credibility if you were a heterosexual male advocating for a homosexual bill than a homosexual individual advocating for a homosexual bill?
I think it helped that I was an ally, but I think also it helped that I was a professor of constitutional law because I always put it in constitutional terms.
Mm-hmm.
Because oftentimes people would raise this as a religious question. And, you know, when I had testified in the Maryland Senate, which was the only time I went there before I got elected,
mm-hmm.
it was against a Republican effort to ban same-sex marriage in the state constitution, and this senator Nancy Jacobs said to me, me, Professor, you keep talking about due process and equal protection, but what about the Bible? The Bible says marriage is between one man and one woman. And what I said to her was kind of my frame for understanding this whole thing. I said, Senator, with all due respect, when you took your oath of office, you put your hand on the Bible and you swore to uphold the Constitution. You did not put your hand on the Constitution and swear to uphold the Bible.
Right.
And so the argument we were making on the marriage question was the church decides exactly who gets married in the church hall whenever it wants. They can discriminate on the basis of race, sexual orientation, ethnicity,
interfaith,
whatever they want.
So it's fine for a Catholic bishop to say, look, I have no interest in marrying a man to another man and I won't do it. And that's legal in Maryland still.
Absolutely. They decide who gets married in the church hall, but in city hall, constitutional standards have to govern. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that Maryland got there a year or so before the Supreme Court did, but to me it was very clear where we were going with the Obergefell decision. Now let me just say one more thing about the Obergefell decision.
And for our listeners, Obergefell was a Supreme Court case that legalized marriage equality across the United States.
Yeah, and it was brought by a gay couple from Ohio,
mm-hmm.
One of whom died before the decision came down. But Mr. Obergefell was in the courtroom, and after he spoke, he was mobbed by the reporters, and they said to him, how do you feel? And he said, I feel elated, but I want to thank the people of Maryland, because had they not done what they did, we would not have been able to fly to BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport to get married on the tarmac,
mm-hmm.
only to go back to Ohio to have our marriage dishonored by our state government,
mm-hmm.
which then is what led to the decision. And so, you know, I was proud of that. And I was proud of the fact that we abolished the death penalty after four centuries in the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was the floor leader on that one, too. And I got up and I said to the I said to the whole Senate, I want to give you a little tutorial on the history of capital punishment in our state.
Mm-hmm.
The first case I could find was execution of runaway slaves. Then there was execution of indentured servants who were convicted of conspiring to run away or to kill their master. Then there's a period where you find the hanging of witches on the Eastern Shore. And then there's a period where the only people who are ever killed are African Americans. And I say, but now fast forward till today. Everything's fine, right? We've got a perfectly pure system. Well, no. Look up in the gallery tonight, and there's a guy there whose name is Kirk Bloodsworth.
Mm-hmm.
He's the first person on the planet Earth ever exonerated from death row because of DNA evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been convicted of the most gruesome, grisly rape murder of a 9-year-old girl you could ever imagine. The prosecutor in the case, Scott Schellenberger, swore 1,000% this was the guy. He fit the FBI composite portrait exactly. He fit the FBI psychological profile exactly. He swore he didn't do it. The first trial ended in a hung jury. The second trial, he was convicted. And every day...
How did he get two trials? Isn't there a double jeopardy law?
Well, no. If it's a hung jury, you can be prosecuted again.
Okay.
They brought the case again.
And for our listeners, a hung jury is a jury that doesn't arrive at a decision?
Unanimous verdict, yeah.
Okay.
So he was convicted. He told his jailer every day that you guys have an innocent man here. And the jailer said to us later in testimony, what was I supposed to do? Everybody's innocent in jail, right? But Bloodsworth read about DNA evidence. He called his lawyer, who's now the chief judge on the D.C. Superior Court Judge Morin,
mm-hmm.
and begged him to get the test. And Morin took $5,000 out of his own pocket,
mm-hmm.
to get a DNA test for this guy who fit the physical profile exactly and everything. And it comes back 99.9% certain it could not have been Bloodsworth. And they found a positive DNA match with a guy who was one floor below him in prison at the time,
mm-hmm.
and who confessed to the crime then. And he was set to get out of prison.
Why did he confess to the crime?
Well, they had him dead to rights because they, you know, they had the DNA evidence, and he spilled his guts. And so I wasn't in the General Assembly at the time, but they gave Bloodsworth $400,000 for his troubles,
mm-hmm.
and they let him out. But if he had been executed before, mm-hmm. which very easily could have happened, and had this...
It may have happened in previous decades before there was DNA testing.
Undoubtedly it did. And
so the reason you oppose the death penalty is because it's almost inevitable that at some point an innocent man will be executed by the state, and that alone is enough reason to abolish the death penalty.
And it has certainly happened.
Mm-hmm.
It has certainly happened. And I said on the floor, addressing the Republicans, the death penalty is a great system for people who think that government is perfect and infallible,
mm-hmm.
which is not usually what we hear from Republicans about government.
Right.
Usually they say government can't do anything right. Here they say government can't do anything wrong. But if you think that government can make a mistake, then capital punishment is not for you. And I was very proud that we brought some Republicans over and we voted to abolish the death penalty and became the first state south of the Mason-Dixon line to abolish the death penalty in American history.
Interesting. But if you were to do an academic exercise and in a theoretical situation, you know, there was absolute certainty that some man, let's say, murdered a few people and raped a few people.
Yes.
And would you ever believe that the death penalty would be appropriate if you had, in a theoretical situation, absolute certainty? Or do you not want to be part of a society that has a state execute people?
Well, I mean, actually, in a moral sense, there are clearly people who set themselves at war against humanity. And I have no problem as a moral proposition that they've forfeited their right to live. I mean, a great example of that is Saddam Hussein. But Saddam Hussein's a really interesting example because we went ahead and executed Saddam Hussein mm-hmm. when he had all kinds of information mm-hmm. about what was really taking place in Iraq. He had potentially devastating testimony about weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. And then his execution also caused huge problems throughout the Middle East. So as a practical matter, the death penalty has never worked. Mm-hmm. It's always been riddled with bias, with disproportion, with error, because human beings are fallible. But now I have no problem saying that there are people who basically have forfeited in a moral sense their right to live. But governments are very complicated instruments.
Now you're moving to the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Congress. Yeah. I'm sorry, the U.S. House of Representatives from the state Senate. And when you're moving to the U.S. Congress, you're going to have potentially jurisdiction over international issues if that's a committee that you get on or if there's a bill that you have to vote on. And, you know, throughout much of history, death wasn't the punishment, but almost a reprieve, right? So if somebody did something heinous, according to society at that time, the punishment would be a whole bunch of torture and pain, and then the reprieve would be the execution. And now, you said if there's lots of bad things, the punishment is forfeiture of life in this, you know, with some terrorists or something. So the idea is, how do you feel about torture, since that is something that I believe our current the next administration after Obama supports the use of that the United States has committed in the last decade. So how do you feel about that?
Okay. Just one quick point on the other thing. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that Kirk Bloodsworth said is that as a categorical opponent to the death penalty, and he is campaigning against it, he said that death is far too good a punishment for people who really do commit crimes like the one he was falsely convicted of, mm-hmm. And that people should be forced to deal with the reality of what they did and to live in the fairly horrible circumstances of people who live on death row and in prison. Mm-hmm. But in any event, torture, look, the historical revolution against torture, which the American Revolution was an important part of, marks enormous progress in the history of humanity. I mean, we inscribed in our Constitution in the Eighth Amendment that there shall not be cruel and unusual punishment. And we've set ourselves against torture. The minute that you allow a government or a state to engage in torture, you have given the means of absolute control in the state. Mm-hmm. So for people who are statists and who glorify the state and idolize the state and trend towards fascism, then torture is an obvious tool that they want. For people who are part of the democratic and liberal revolutions of the 18th and 19th century and see those as a marked advance in human understanding and relationship, torture is absolutely abominable. For people who set themselves at war against civilization, we want to, well, if we're in a war with them, we have to kill them. But if we have access to them and we can capture them and put them in prison, mm-hmm. then that's what we do. Mm-hmm. And not because of who they are, but because of who we are, mm-hmm. and because of what our values are, and because we understand that once you let the genie of torture out of the bottle, it's very hard to get back in. And we also don't want our people being tortured by governments and regimes abroad. If they get captured in the context of war or kidnapping or whatever. We want that to be a war crime and a violation of the Geneva Convention.
So I want to transition to your transition to Congress. Now, it's been said that Congress is in a deadlock, and it was very highly likely that the U.S. House of Representatives would remain Republican. It was unknown whether the U.S. Senate and presidency would remain Republican, but now we know that all three will be in your first term. Many individuals, even when you were running for office before you had won, had said, why do you want to go from a Senate where you've been so successful in getting so many pieces of legislation passed, where Democrats control both houses of the legislature, to somewhere where you'll be in a minority and you'll get nothing passed? I want to make an analogy to what you said before, which was, look, I want to be in the moral center, not the political center. Bring the political center to me. How are you going to use that kind of strategy to make yourself effective and not just a shrill voice in Congress who gets ignored because you're in a minority party?
Well, I mean, I think that is the essential question I'm facing as I enter upon this new journey here in Congress. You're right. Lots of colleagues in the Senate, lots of colleagues at AU Law School, lots of people in my family have said, hey, you know, you've had great legislative success. The Washington Post, which otherwise considers me too liberal, said, you know, I had prodigious legislative success because I go to work. And because for me, politics is just an expression of education. It's just a continuation of educating people about the process and about the issues and what kind of progress we can make together. But, you know, so I am going from a situation where I've been able to get these things done to one where I don't know. But I may go from playing offense to playing defense for a while, and it's going to require me to, you know, develop a whole new set of skills being in the minority. But I always reached out to Republicans in the state Senate. I co-sponsored lots of legislation, especially criminal justice reform bills with Republicans. We abolished the mandatory minimum sentences in drug cases. We reformed civil asset and seizure and forfeiture laws so the government can't just take people's property and then accuse the property of being guilty of something, essentially, and then making you go prove it later. We built a conservative liberal coalition of people to get together to say that's unconstitutional. That's not the way that we do things in America. So I want to try to build those coalitions in Washington, D.C., even if I'm coming from the minority as opposed to the majority. I want to build criminal justice reform coalitions. I want to build coalitions on budget transparency, on election reform, on attacking gerrymandering, on reforming campaign finance, and so on.
So I want to, as we approach the end of the podcast, bring the topic a little bit around to legacy. Now, you're leaving a legacy in the state Senate after having been there for a decade. I'd like you to reflect on that. And one day, hopefully, one day you'll be live long enough that you will be a former U.S. congressman, whether you move on to higher office from there or retire maybe 30 years in the future. But at one point, unless you die in office, you'll be a former congressman. So what was your legacy in the state Senate, and what will you hope your legacy will be in the U.S. House of Representatives?
Well, that's a kind question. I still feel a little bit too young to be talking about legacy, but let's start with District 20, which is a community that I love here in Silver Spring and Tacoma Park. We have a very vibrant, lively political culture, and we pride ourselves on cultivating young political leadership. So, you know, we went from having an all-white delegation when I started to now one where we, up until last week, it was me, Sheila Hickson, the first woman chair of the Ways and Means Committee, David Moon, who ran my first campaign and is a great, very talented young political organizer and leader, and Will Smith, who ran our 2010 campaign, who's a young, brilliant African-American leader and organizer and lawyer. So we've got a great political culture, and, you know, we're just about to go off to our District 20 meeting. So that's one legacy.
And David Moon is Asian-American.
And David Moon is Asian-American, right? So we've got great diversity. We might be the most diverse. I think we are the most progressive and effective delegation in the state. And that's an extraordinary legacy to have right here. Because, you know, when I first ran back in 2006, it was much more machine-type politics that governed here. And I think that we became an example also to other legislative districts of how you build real progressive direction and community and solidarity among people in politics. So it's not just an ego exercise where people go out and
fight
each other.
So just to paraphrase, a legacy of independence, of creating a backbench to rise up of young leaders after you, following you, and then also and progressive legislation and then diversity. Is that basically what you just said?
Yeah, and not being afraid to stand up for the things that we believe in. Not everything is about winning. And actually, if you stand for the things you believe in, you end up winning more, and it means more. So on matters of style, I always go with the flow. You know, I'm willing to put on a tuxedo if I have to. I'm willing to put on a bathing suit if I have to. I prefer not to. But on matters of principle, on matters of substance, we stand like a rock. We hang tough.
Have you had to compromise at all?
Oh, sure. I've compromised a million times. You know, the politics is the art of compromise, but it's also the art of finding the principles and values that you're not going to compromise on and standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you compromise on other stuff to get done the big things that you want to do. You know, I remember I was being lobbied on a bill about the helicopter transport in the state of Maryland when I was doing the marriage equality thing. And I was very willing to see things the way of the senator who was lobbying me when I said, if you just listen to me for 10 minutes, talk about marriage equality. So we got some big things done, and I'm
so
proud of that.
You supported his helicopter thing to get his support of the marriage equality thing.
I mean, it probably was not so explicit, but something like that was in the air.
And so, you know, how are you going to be remembered as a former congressman? What are you going to do in the next term, few terms, however long you're there? What are you going to hope to be remembered by?
Well, I hope to be a great constitutional patriot in Congress. I want to champion the real values of our Constitution, civil rights and civil liberties and equality for all. It will be a great honor and I think responsibility for me to stand up and rise and to refute all of the nonsense that has been spouted by the Tea Party about what our Constitution says and what it means. And I think I will be prepared to do that. I also want to be a great constituent servant. I was very proud that I was rated the most responsive elected official in Montgomery County by the Silver Spring and Tacoma Voice.
Is a newspaper.
Or at least it was a newspaper. It may be defunct now. I think it's online.
Okay.
I think they're reviving it online. But tough times for the newspaper business. But yeah, I mean, I hope to go and champion the great values and principles and priorities of the people of our area. And look, we haven't talked about climate change or global warming. Maybe we can do another one, Jordan. This was a lot of fun. But I do hope to be part of a political generation that breaks from the carbon paradigm, ushers in a renewable energy future, and helps to save us from the most calamitous consequences of climate change.
Are there existential threats to any in the world today?
Well, that is one. That's the overarching context. I said in my campaign, I would never describe it as an issue because it's not an issue. It's the whole context within which we've got to decide everything else. And we do also still have to deal with, these, you know, terrorist death cults all over the world that masquerade in the name of religion have set themselves at war against humanity. That obviously is a pretty big threat.
I can't resist one last thing, which is Stephen Hawking, a noted physicist in the United Kingdom, has predicted that humanity may have only a millennium left on this planet. And since you're going to Congress, you would have some influence over funding for NASA, the National Aeronautics Space Administration. Would you be interested in supporting more funding for space exploration and potentially missions to Mars?
I think our challenges are pretty severe right here on planet Earth right now. And look, if the budget were infinite, then by all means.
Prioritize.
I grew up on Star Trek like everybody else, you know. But I do think that, you know, we've got to invest in the problems here. And I do think that humanity does not create problems for itself that humanity cannot solve. But we do create the problems first, and we're dealing with them now.
So that has been Senator Jamie Raskin, now Congressman-elect Jamie Raskin, who, ending on a light note, but with all due seriousness, has brought to light many issues, from climate change, ending the death penalty, marriage equality, issues of civil rights and civil law, wishing to be remembered as a constitutional scholar, a champion in protection of the liberties of all in the United States, also willing to supersede national or local interests in the interests of all mankind, speaking about international security issues and also existential threats posed by global warming. He's someone who is proud of his successes as a liberal champion who is able to compromise but is also able to define his moral center, which is a compass for him in a political context where he brings other people to where he thinks everyone ought to be, a legacy of independence, commitment to public service, and diversity in thought and in demographics. So this has been episode 52 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.